Bonjour mes amis, ici Zachary Richard et si vous ne le savez pas, vous écoutez The Paul Leslie Hour, l'heure à Paul Leslie. Merci beaucoup.
Hey, are you here or are you here? Well, in truth, we already know. You're here. You're tuned in to the Paul Leslie Hour. Welcome! We've got an interview with Zachary Richard, a cultural activist, singer, songwriter, poet. He writes and sings in English and en français with deep roots to his native Louisiana. He will be talking about the purpose of his art and also what it was like recording a duet with Celine Dion and his friendship with the late great Jimmy Buffett. By the way, Zachary Richard will be performing at this year's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival on Friday, May 3rd. Simply visit nojazzfest.com for more info. You can also support the Paul Leslie Hour. Way to go, champ. And give yourself and others the gift of stories. Simply visit www.thepaulleslie.com/support, and we thank you. Now let's get into the interview.
Hey, it's me.
Peace.
How are you?
Okay.
Good, good. So thank you so much for joining us.
Us? Who's us?
All the people who will be watching.
Oh, okay. Well, how y'all doing?
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm in the middle of a book tour and looking out the window, and the snow has almost all melted. It's retreated to the four corners of the shady spots. So I guess spring has sprung.
Yes, it's where I am, it's pretty warm right now. Where are you at the moment?
Montreal.
Okay. Well, yep. Good of you to join us. I've had quite a good time going through and listening to all of the recordings of yours that I possibly can, and it's been a great exploration. Zachary, what has always been the purpose of the art you create?
I don't know if we can define a purpose. The reason that I started dragging myself around the world with a series of instruments was to have fun and meet women. But the ultimate purpose, I think, of creativity, of creative art, is to share humanity. If we go back far enough, it was about 200,000 years ago that our ancestors came out of the trees, and about 60,000 years that we came out of Africa, and about 30,000 years ago that the cave paintings in Lascaux were made. And there was a point in our progress that as human beings, as what became human beings, that we came into touch with the spiritual aspect of our experience. And in order to experience it that fully, we began to create art. I mean, whether it was cave paintings or beating on the mammoth skin with a femur, or with a tiger, saber-toothed tiger femur, or whether it was chanting or the spoken word. I think the original human intent of creativity was to encounter the spirit world, and to in a communal sense, especially in the sense of music, to create a path, a bridge between the spiritual and the physical, and to do that as a community, at least in the sense of music, you know, getting together and dancing and singing and playing whatever form of music that we were able to utilize at any particular time. I think the purpose of all of that was to not only to celebrate, but also to participate in to the spiritual aspect of our nature in its fullest sense. And that sounds a little cerebral when you think about what music does. Music, it comforts, it soothes, it allows us to escape from turmoil and the daily grind of just human life. But there's something very fundamentally spiritual about what I do. And it sounds kind of pretentious, and I don't take myself to be a spiritual guide. I'm just a songwriter. But through the songs, what I hope to do is to communicate some of the essence of my experience as a human being and to share that with other people.
Well, well put. I'm hoping on the note of your experience, you can tell us a little bit about your early days. What would you say your life was like? What was life like growing up around the house?
I grew up in a bilingual household, a very typical Cajun family. And as much as my grandparents did not speak English, and so there was that very exuberant joie de vivre that I had access to on a daily basis that were basically, we lived right next door to my grandparents. And I think that's one of the reasons that I've become so attached to celebrating and creating in French is that there was, when I was a small child, such a cocoon of love and of bonheur, of positive feeling, that I've spent most of my life trying to find it again. And it just happened to be in French. My parents were typical of their generation in as much as they were assimilated and they had gone through the experience of going to public school at an early age and being told that their maternal tongue was not only a handicap, but it was a social problem. So there was that assimilation, which was practiced on very small young children in Southwest Louisiana, that created an ambivalence about the linguistic culture, that we were never really sure if it was worth anything. And that's why I think there was an entire rush by the generation of my parents to assimilate and to become fully Anglo-American, which I don't think we ever really achieved, but that was, I think, the intention. And otherwise, it was like, you know, pretty typical. I just, you know, I played sports with my neighbors, and with my friends. I went to school. The most probably significant event of my childhood is being auditioning for and being selected to become a singer in the Bishop's Boys Choir in Lafayette, Louisiana. Bishop Maurice Shakesnyder had this ambition to give the Vienna Boys Choir a run for its money. And so there was I guess there was about 30 of us, and we practiced every day. And I auditioned, and I was selected to be a choir member at 9 years old. So I was singing every day during the school year, in any event, Monday through Friday, and then we'd sing the High Mass on Sunday for the bishop. And I was brought up in a very traditional Catholic household, so that ritual, and I'm no longer a practicing Catholic, but I think I'm still very attracted to ritual. And the fact of singing High Mass every Sunday for the bishop was something that really rocked me as a kid. But I think the most important thing was that it gave me not only the ability to sing, but also the love of singing. So that later on in life, when I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, I was 14, and I went, oh yeah, I want to do that. The ability to sing and this musical foundation was part of my life. My parents were not musicians. There was no real musicians in my family. So where that came from, it's always been kind of a mystery in the family. But I was fortunate enough to have a very profound musical experience at a very young age. And that just became transformed when I went from singing for the choir to singing for the devil in rock and roll band, you know. but singing, and you know, just to get back to the earlier point about spirituality, there's something about singing. I've been meditating in a Soto Zen tradition for about 50 years, and I've made like maybe no progress whatsoever on my spiritual path. But when I sing, the integration of spirit and flesh, it takes place in a very profound way. And that's, you know, it's the diaphragm and pushing air through your lungs and having it come out your mouth. And that ability to incarnate this very creative spirit is something that I learned at a very young age, fortunately. But then otherwise, it was pretty typical. I went to high school. I wasn't that good at sports. So I wasn't that good with girls. Then I went to college, and it was 1968, and it was like, uh-oh. So my father, for the longest time, he was very distraught because he imagined that he had wasted all that money on an education that really didn't pay off in the way that he expected, at least originally. He wanted me to become a lawyer or a doctor or mm-hmm. one of those. And when I became a musician, and it was like I got out of college and I went to New York City and started playing in the streets. And that was a very difficult time for my parents, but I was having a great time. And then I got a record contract at a young age, and boom, I just realized I could do it. And I haven't stopped. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but I tried.
you did. You absolutely did. These days, do you have a preference in terms of singing in French or English? Is there one that tends to pull on your heartstrings more?
That's a really interesting question because I really am bilingual. I mean, I'm perfectly bilingual. My French was very haphazard, in as much as Cajun French is French. It's not some kind of weird idiom. It is French with a syntax style and a vocabulary and an accent that's all its own and unique, but it's nonetheless French. But the French that we speak in Louisiana is very unique. And I did not have much of a foundation for literacy, for French literacy in the French from standard French point of view. So I would basically, I had a very large vocabulary, but I would just translate. And that's why even today, my syntax style is very English as opposed to French. But, you know, I grew up in I think my coming of age was going to college in 68. So the Vietnam War was something that was on everybody's mind. And I just came from Vancouver. And in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a very significant migration of young Americans fleeing the draft who wound up in Vancouver and who've left a very marked influence on that community. And I could have been one of those. I just had a really high number in the lottery. So I just realized that, and this was like 1970, 71, that all I really wanted to do was to play music and to sing songs. And it's very curious to me, but my primary influences were Canadian, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, and Bob Dylan. And even though Bob Dylan was born in Minnesota, for us in Louisiana, that's like just pretty much like Canada. So I grew up in a very, in terms of style, in a very traditional folk rock American influence. And then I got a record deal and had money. So, and I was 21 years old. So what I did was bought some guitars. What else do you do with money when you're 21? But then I had some money left over and I went to see Mark Savoy in Eunice, Louisiana, and convinced him. And it took me a while because he didn't want to sell me the thing, but I bought one of those 10-button diatonic Cajun accordions and was literally whooshed into this very powerful current of French music, Cajun music, what people call Cajun music. And I had no idea that even existed. In my generation, people were listening to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. We didn't know anything about Ira Lejeune or Blackie Forestier or Belton Richard or all of the Cajun musicians who were still working in South Louisiana. That culture had been relegated pretty much to the margins of Cajun society, and the mainstream was very much assimilated Anglo-American. And when I discovered that, it just went boom! My imagination, my musical and literary imagination just exploded, and I started playing accordion with a passion and getting into, for lack of a better term, traditional Cajun music. But I was still writing songs in a folk rock genre, and then I don't want to say that it was designed. But anyway, I wound up in Quebec City in 1975, and my worldview changed because I encountered a society which was forcefully engaged for what I would consider to be a survival of a struggle for its own survival. French in Canada had been, as it had been in North America, dominated for so long. And then in the 1960s, in sync with everything else that was going on in the world, the Quebecois found this new identity. And it was one which was aggressively proud, which had been in contrast with the sort of discerning, kowtowing, subservient French language culture of the generations prior. And then it became, okay, we got this thing that we can do and we're going to do it. And I was just parachuted right into the middle of all of this. And I went, oh, okay. So this sort of in my heart, it replaced the struggle for a new society And it was, okay, well, it's going to be power to the French people from now on. So I was swept up in that. And so to answer your question, I mean, it's kind of a convoluted answer, but there's something about my French experience that I will never have in English, although I'm proud to be an American in certain aspects of the culture. There's some amazing things about America and its culture. There's some things that I'm not crazy about, but that's the story for another day. But I don't think that the thing about being part of a minority linguistic culture that is threatened everywhere, because the rates of assimilation across North America, I mean, in Louisiana, we're, I don't know, maybe 2-4% of the population that speak French still. In Quebec, obviously, it's the majority, but in all of the other provinces of Canada, it'll vary from 30% to in New Brunswick to 4% in British Columbia. So it's a struggle on a daily basis to be able to get serviced in hospitals and schools and all the institutions of daily life. French language culture in North America is in a survival mode, and that appeals to me. The struggle appeals to me. It's like, okay, if you love something, it's sort of like the natural environment, generally speaking, in my case specifically in South Louisiana. But when something that you love is threatened, your reaction is always to protect it, to attempt to protect it and to preserve it. And that's something that I have in French that I'll never have in English. And I'm probably a much better author, or it's easier for me in English, put it that way. But if you're talking about heart, there's something about my French experience, and it's from my grandparents, through my parents, through my day-to-day activity, not only in Southwest Louisiana, but in Quebec or in Canada, where I spend about half of my time, there's something that resonates in my heart, because the tradition is significant, and the importance of the lessons of tolerance and inclusion, which are at the base of French experience throughout the world, are something that appealed to me greatly. So, yeah, I would have to say, you know, if I wanted to use a cliche, then English is the language of my head and French is the language of my heart.
That's interesting. A comment on that. You know, I don't speak French, but in listening to your albums, there have been some songs that have just really, they've really knocked me over in an emotional sense, even though I don't know what it was you were saying, you know. Because when I hear the fiddle playing an old-time Cajun song, moonlight on the bayou, gonna keep dancing all night long. Don't stand, hey, we gonna dance the night. I'll say, go, let go, then I'll say, tonight is the night for romance. Can I have the pleasure? Oh, the pleasure of this dance.
I became kind of acquainted through your music, through the album that you did, Last Kiss. That was the first one that I got in my collection. And another singer, these days she's going through health issues. There's a track on there. You sing with Celine Dion. Can you tell us what kind of person is she? What was she like to be around?
This was a long time ago. So, you know, and I don't know Celine that well. I mean, I've shared the stage with her. I've been in the studio with her, but I can't say that we're like pals. But I will say that she's probably the hardest working person that I have ever met, you know, and that includes my father, who is like dramatically devoted to hard work. When I called Renee, and because we had met before, I had actually, you know, she's got a huge family, and a couple of her sisters were fans of mine, so I had sang at one of their birthday parties, and so I was like, you know, in the club, and what, you know, I was always and still am a huge fan of Robbie Robertson and the band. And I wanted to do a cover of The Wait, because that's one of the greatest songs that's ever been written, I think. And so I called Renee and I said, well, I'm going to send over this version. And would Celine try to, you know, I don't know whose idea it was, if it was mine or if it was like a promo guy saying, well, get Celine on the record, you know, you're going to sell a million. But it was a little bit more organic than that. So I called Renee and I said, well, I got this song and it's not mine, but I think that we could do a really great version of it. So I sent him The Wait, and then they said, meh, maybe not. And so I said, well, what the hell else? Okay. Acadian Driftwood. That seems to make sense, you know, because Celine is on her mother's side, on the Bellevue side, she's Acadian. She has Acadian heritage. So I said, well, that's perfect. I mean, it'll mean something to her. So everybody said, oh, she's such a diva. She's going to be late and she's not going to want to. She got there like a half hour early and she started like warming up. And I'm going, man, this girl is serious. And we must have sang that song, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 times. I don't know, a lot. And then at the end, it was like, you know, and she kept saying, I want to do it again. I can do it better. And everybody's going, what time is it? We've been here for 5 hours. So she is, I think, the consummate, I don't want to say performer, because that I don't think that does her justice. You know, the consummate performing artist. She takes her craft so seriously, and she's been doing it for so long. I mean, I met her when she was like 10, you know, when she was just starting out. And because Renee Angelil was a promoter. He was in the business before they were even, before he even managed Celine. I had done some gigs for him. And anyway, so when she became one of the most astoundingly popular singers in the history of modern music, and she deserves the recognition. She deserves the credit, because that woman works so hard. So I can't really give you an insight into her personality. I don't know her that well. She was always nice to me, and I assume that she's like, you know, she's a nice person. But the thing that impressed me still is her devotion to her craft. And it's got to be heartbreaking for her not to be able to exercise her craft at this time. But she has a real strong sense of family around her. So, I got to hope that she's going to be okay.
Absolutely. We're all hoping. There's a singer, a songwriter who is no longer with us, who you and he were friends, and I'm talking about Jimmy Buffett. He performed on the recording of your song, Who Stole My Monkey, as one of the background vocalists. He also was such a huge proponent of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I'm hoping you can just share a little bit of your memories of Jimmy.
You know, Jimmy was like, a specialist at making people feel good. and he worked at it. You know, I mean, he was like this very successful, hugely rich, whatever that genre he did, country, folk, beach singer. But he always really took the time with the people around him to make you feel like you were special, you know. It was never, you know, I'm Jimmy Buffett, get out of my way. It was always, hey, what can I do for you? You know, how can I help you? He was a good man. You know, fundamentally, he was just a decent fellow, and he liked to party. You know, I mean, Jimmy made a fortune out of partying and getting people to party with him. And he was very astute, because, you could say, well, you know, it's just a lucky beach bum, but the dude had some serious sense, and he was able to parlay, I think, a desire of evasion that we all share, just to get away from, you know, the humdrum of life, and to escape into this mythical beach paradise, where, you know, the hardest thing you have to do is to lift the margarita glass to your lips. So, and it was fun being around Jimmy, because those concerts were just like, and I spent like 3 months with him, I guess it was in one summer. And, you know, it was just people crazy. You know, the Parrot Heads were like stoned out. And when I found out that he was sick, I was just, well, you know, that was a bad year. Between him and Robbie Robertson going, like a wake-up call from the universe saying, you know, it's like, it's time to get serious about life and start loving people all, as much as you can, because one of these days, Papa, you know, one of these days, Papa, it's, you know, somebody's going to have to call in the chips and cash out.
What is the best thing about being Zachary Richard?
Whoa, you need to ask my wife. best thing about me is, I think, you know, the best thing is I'm just lucky, you know. I'm so fortunate to, I mean, I've had my share of ups and downs. There is no artistic career that is without travail. And but I never really stopped believing in. I never really thought about doing anything else, you know, once I started. So it couldn't have been that hard for me. Although there were periods where, you know, when I lost a record deal, or I wasn't on the charts, or nothing was happening. It's never easy, especially when you've had a little bit of taste of success. But I think the thing about me that is the most surprising is how fortunate that I am, you know, to be able to practice a job that I really love and that I get to share with people. Because, I mean, I love writing the songs and I love performing the songs, but it doesn't really make any sense unless I can share that with other people. And it's not about the recognition or the glory or the money. It's really all about being able to do something in a positive way to help people. And you know, we're talking about Celine Dion, who's just a phenomenal singer, but you could say, oh, you know, it's just pop music. But even pop music in its essence is a noble cause, because if you can just get somebody to stop thinking about their problems and to just dream for 3 minutes, you've done something to help people. And I've been lucky enough to be able to do that for my whole life. So the most important thing about Zachary Richard is that he's just a lucky son of a bitch.
Very good. Well, I always like to end my shows. I give the guest the stage. It can feel dangerous sometimes, but you can go anywhere with this. It's a totally open-ended. You have the stage completely. What would you like to say to anybody who is tuned in with us in closing?
Make haste to love. You know, life is short. You never know what's going to happen. Take care of the people around you. Take care of yourself. Just take care. Take care of the birds and the bees and the plants and the trees and the water and the air. Life is too short. It's too precious. Make haste to love.
Beautifully put. Beautifully put. I would like to say hello also to Jeff Pike. I know he's watching this because he told me that one of the best shows that he ever saw, live shows, he saw you perform in the 90s. And that was kind of what got me going down this Zachary Richard rabbit hole. So hello to Jeff. And thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. Hey, Jeff.
All right.
Thanks so much. If I can ever be of service, I'm always here.
Well, thanks for the time, Paul. I appreciate it. And all the best in all of your endeavors. And, you know, just keep on doing it, bro.
Thank you, sir. You as well. All right. Until next time.
A la prochaine.
We thank you and appreciate you dropping in for the Paul Leslie Hour today. You know, you can help the Paul Leslie Hour in our mission to provide independent media content like this by visiting www.thepaulleslie.com/support. We truly thank you. This is your announcer speaking. Performance of The Entertainer intro song and Corina Corina outro song, courtesy of John Premorano. Well, that's it for today. So until next time, be safe and be good.